Good afternoon. I'm Cal Winslow, your host today. Our program is an Antinomian Hour, and I'm using the word antinomian, a very old concept, one that's associated with a sort of historic line of descent, to describe people who work against the grain, people who think for themselves, who believe that doing the right thing is the important thing. The program consists of a series of in-depth interviews, and this series, this summer series, concludes today. Our guest this afternoon is Professor Robin Spencer. Professor Spencer is an associate professor of history at Lehman College at the City University of New York. She received her PhD at Columbia University, and then before coming to Lehman, she taught African and African-American studies and history at Penn State University. Her interests include black social protest after World War II, urban and working class radicalism, and gender. At Lehman, she teaches courses on 20th century African-American history. Her new book, which is forthcoming from Duke University Press next year, is a study of the Black Panther Party, tentatively entitled Repression Breeds Resistance, The Rise and Fall of the Black Panther Party in Oakland, California, 1966 to 1982. She's also the author of the study Communalism and the Black Panther Party in Oakland, California in the 1970s, and that was published in the collection West of Eden, Communes and Utopia in Northern California. Good afternoon, Robin.
Good afternoon.
Is it okay to call you Robin?
Yes, please do.
Okay. Well, I wonder if we could just begin by maybe you could tell us what to look forward to in your new book. I suspect it's going to be highly relevant. You might begin with the what might be the title, Repression Breeds Resistance.
Right. The new book that I've completed is a study of the history of the Black Panther Party in Oakland, California. So it examines the Black Panther Party's evolution, their roots in the migration of African Americans from the South to the West, and the struggle to fight police brutality, to address housing shortages, inequities in the school system, as well as all of the other social ills that plagued Black Oakland at the time. The Black Panther Party arose in Oakland to combat that, and they became one of the leading Black power organizations. So there's wonderful literature out there about the Panthers, and I'm excited to add my voice to the chorus. So my study looks at the Panthers' organizational history. So it looks at the impact that gender had on how they evolved. I look at things like leadership, the impact of repression as an organizational dynamic within the Black Panther Party, and really how the Panthers tried to create a vehicle for social change. And what were the results of that? What were the concrete impacts on the communities of Oakland, and as well, I look a little bit at the nationwide impact and even their global impact.
Okay, and could you say a bit about the setting Oakland in the period that you're writing about?
Well, Oakland in the 1960s was quite an exciting place. One of the things that was striking about Oakland for me, especially when I first started doing research coming out from where I live, which is in New York on the East Coast, is just the diversity of Oakland, California, the proximity of Oakland to Berkeley and that history, rich history of protests there, to San Francisco and the struggles for Black studies and recognition of Black students on college campuses that were going on there, and Oakland really as a place where working class Black people had gained a foothold, yet had still so many unmet needs in terms of just the quality of their daily lives, their human rights, and things like that. So Oakland at the time was really an exciting place because it was really the crossroads for all of this. The other exciting thing about Oakland in terms of diversity is just the ethnic diversity that's there. So the panthers, as they grew, they interacted with and intersected with Asian Americans. You know, in Oakland, the Chinatown is right downtown, you know, very close to many black communities. And there was so much interaction, intersection that went on there, as well as Chicanos and the connections there. So Oakland, I think, is a unique place in that it is, it has this core black community, yet the community is certainly in conversation with so many other social forces, so many other marginalized groups struggling for voice. So I think that's what made Oakland in the 1960s a pretty unique place.
And some listeners will know a bit about the Black Panther Party, but maybe you could just give us a very brief thumbnail sketch of its origins and early history.
Sure, sure. Well, the Panthers started in 1966 in Oakland, California, founded by Huey Newton and Bobby Seale. As both of them were students at the community college there at the time, Merritt College, and both of them had spent some time as activists in various black nationalist political formations that were on the ground in Oakland before they got together. So it's really a relatable story. It's basically the story of these men who were struggling for a political outlet for themselves, and when they didn't find something that met their needs, they created it. Yet it's beyond the story of these two individuals. It's also the story of the community around them that gravitated towards the call that the Panthers made for the social and political change, as well as the larger story of the movement for black power in the U.S., which the Panthers were an integral part of. So when Huey Newton and Bobby Seale started the Panthers, they created the founding document, the 10-point platform and program, which laid out the basic ideals and goals of the Black Panther Party. So it talked about economic justice. It talked about fighting back against police repression in the black community. It talked about housing. It talked about peace. So even though it was a very simple document, they wrote it simply because they wanted to appeal to a mass base, right? They wanted it to be something that that anyone could understand and relate to and hook into. So even though it was written in simpler terms, it was very rich in terms of the goals and the vision of a society that it set out. So the 10-point platform and program, Huey Newton and Bobby Seale went around their communities, their school, their networks, and began to muster support for the organization. And in the context of black power, when so many African Americans were newly conscientized around issues of identity, politics, culture, internationalism, the Panthers were one of many groups that were out there advocating, and they attracted people for what became their hallmark, which was their commitment to armed self-defense. So the Panthers, some of their initial actions had to do with meeting community needs. So they struggled for, and they organized to get a traffic light at a busy corner where people had been killed. So those sort of quality of life issues, as well as addressing police brutality by creating initial police patrols. They began as a local organization. They grew to regional prominence, and after they went down to the state capitol in Sacramento to protest the fact that there was a law being passed making their weapons that they were carrying legally and openly now illegal, that action in Sacramento created publicity that went all around the world. And you have many formations and individuals contacting them to be part of the Black Panther Party. And that was the nucleus in the beginning. So they grew to be a nationwide organization. They eventually had a international section in Algeria as well. In addition to the 10-point platform and program and their anti-police brutality work, they also began to institute community programs like their Breakfast for School Children program, their program giving people free shoes. They created health clinics as well. So they really became a network of very committed activists around the country, most of whom were young people, high school, college age, people who dedicated their lives really to being full-time organizers for the Black Panther Party.
And I suppose, sadly, whatever, police repression is still on our minds, and the militarization, especially of the modern police. But the Oakland police always seemed to stand out, the police who came to be, known as the Oakland Pigs. Was there something peculiar or particular about the Oakland Police Department?
Well, the Oakland Police, I think, like many, as I said, the Panthers had their origins in the migration. Well, so did, other people migrated to Oakland as well. So oftentimes you would have Southern whites displaced into Oakland now with the same attitudes and the same sort of context. And in a lot of ways, just like in the South, in the West, the criminal justice system became an agent of repression in the lives of African Americans, especially once they began to push back against the boundaries and challenge the laws that were unfair. So I think the Oakland police were a result of that migration, I would say. I don't think that makes them unique, but I think the context of Oakland was different in that there was just so much political activity. So you see a lot of the repression that the Panthers face from the police is also an offshoot of the repression that the students at Berkeley in the anti-war movement and the free speech movement were also facing as well. So in a lot of ways, I think because of the Governor Reagan, who would become President Reagan later on, Governor Reagan's conservative politics and repressive approach to the local protests that were going on, I think it gave protests in the Bay Area just that particular character.
Okay, now your work also includes a sort of, maybe it's new, maybe that's wrong, approach to the history of the Black Panther Party, or it's certainly a pioneering approach in, as far as I can see, and that's that you've talked about the Black Panther Party and revolutionary black womanhood. I think that's part of the title of an article you wrote. Could you take us to that story within this bigger picture of the party?
Sure. Well, women began to join the Black Panther Party in the spring of 67. So they started in the fall of 66 in October. And throughout their entire history, the struggle for women to gain voice within the organization and to push the organization to actualize their egalitarian rhetoric around gender was really central to the development of the Black Panther. So that's one of the things that I feel is key to thinking about the Panthers as an organizational vehicle, to think about the gender politics within and the ways in which it challenged as an organization. If you look at it from the inside out and the day-to-day lives, it challenged men and women to rethink everything from their relationship to commerce and money, to gender roles, and who was going to do what work. And the Panthers, by not necessarily having a policy in place that would relegate women to certain roles, women within the organization found a sense of freedom in some ways to push back against those restrictions, and to fight back and to find voice. Now, I think within the history of the Black Panthers, of course, like in any organizational formation, like the anti-war movement and the white student movement as well, I mean, you have instances of abuse of women, violence towards women, et cetera. But in terms of what the official policy was and in terms of what went on behind the scenes, the Oakland Panthers really were a place, I feel, and the evidence sort of supports, where women were able to push back against the restrictions that they faced. And they understood those restrictions as things that came from the larger society. I mean, the Panthers were trying to create this new world or model what they wanted the world to look like within the organization. But, of course, everyone came to the organization with their own socialized beliefs. And Black Power, for some organizations at the time, meant the inculcation of masculinity, machoism, men first. And in the context of that atmosphere, the gender expressions that were allowed and encouraged and fought for within the Black Panthers is truly remarkable. So I tell the story of women, the activities women took part in. I look at parenting. I look at motherhood. What did it mean to become a mother and be an activist within the organization? And it's really a fascinating story of survival and transformation and struggle. And I think those are the lessons that we need for today.
I think, Robin, some listeners will, thinking back, will remember Kathleen Cleaver and Elaine Brown and some of the better-known Panther women. But it's my impression that you also kind of look at women in the party sort of from the ground up or the bottom up, at the ordinary women that we haven't heard of in the Panther Party. Is that fair?
Yes. I try to look at the people who did clerical work, the people who worked at the breakfast program, the people who ran the election campaigns and were, you know, key organizers and respected organizers on the ground who may have never had a title within the organization, but still may have exercised power as well. So I try to give different perspectives on what it meant, because, of course, being a high-profile woman, being a woman attached to, whether it be by marriage or association, to a well-known political man, all of those things mediated what women's experiences were.
Okay, and sticking with this for a minute, I see here an article about someone named Connie Matthews. Maybe you could tell us a bit about who she was and why you wrote about her.
Oh, wonderful. Well, Connie Matthews is a really interesting person because she sort of cast the Panthers in an international light. So Connie Matthews was a Jamaican woman who went to Europe for education and became involved in radical politics. And when Bobby Seale went to Scandinavia to do organizing and just to shed light and create publicity and support around the Black Panthers, she met with him and she became their international coordinator. It was a big title, and in a lot of ways, she utilized that title she defined that title on her own terms. Because, of course, Bobby Seale goes back, and she's there with the titles. Now, what to make of this? So she uses all of her networks and contacts. She helps to form support committees for the Panthers in several countries. She travels throughout Europe, and she visits other Panther parties, like the Panthers in England, for example. There's a Black Panther Party there, so she visits with them. She gives speeches. She meets with soldiers who have gone AWOL, African-American soldiers who have gone AWOL and now in Switzerland. So she is somebody who is moving around pretty much without any direct oversight. She was not getting directives or political tracks sent to her from the Bay Area. She, in a lot of ways, she took her understandings of Black power that were forged in the Caribbean and through her experience as a Black person in Europe at the time, part of a burgeoning movement to really define what the Panthers were going to be in Europe and to also rally support. So she was able to rally concrete support. So when Bobby Seale is getting arrested as part of the Chicago demonstrations with other people, she's organizing embassies in European capitals to march on the embassies in support. She's organizing monies to be sent and supplies and things like that. So she spends much of her early career with the Panthers in Europe. Then she goes to Oakland, where she goes and becomes directly connected to Panther leader Huey Newton. She's listed in the records as his personal secretary. And I think that because of that title and because that she subsequently marries a very well-known Panther activist named Michael Tabor, who was part of the New York 21, that she has become seen in the history as someone else's wife and Huey Newton's secretary. Yet, my research has shown that she actually had a hugely independent voice and had a big impact on how the Panthers were seen and sort of crafting the Panthers' image, you know, at a key part of the world where they derived political support. So she's a very interesting story. Like I said, it's an international story. She eventually goes to Algeria. She moves from Algeria with her husband, Michael Tabor, and they move to Zambia, where they become involved in the movement against apartheid in South Africa. She and he subsequently divorce, and she moves back to Jamaica, which is where she was from. So just tracking her story from Jamaica to England, to America, to North Africa, to East Africa, back to Jamaica, it's really the circuit of the black diaspora, and it's a political circuit. It really gives you a different sense of trying to understand the political world that the Panthers operated in.
Okay, Robin, I need to pause here for a moment. This is KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host today, Cal Winslow. Our program is An Antinomian Hour, and our guest is the historian Robin Spencer. She's professor of history at Lehman College at the City University of New York. So let's see, one more question related to those, and that is that one of the publications I mentioned that you authored concerned communalism, and that's in the volume about Utopia in Northern California. Could you explain a bit about communalism and how that played into the history of the Panther Party?
Sure. Now, the Panthers' ideology shifted and changed over time, but they also always, in a way, saw themselves as part of the left, being anti-capitalist. And so they read a lot about socialism. And I think because of those ideological leanings, and also because of just the realities of the time, as I mentioned earlier, when you joined the Black Panthers, you oftentimes gave up your family. You may move into the Panther household. I think just the necessities of the time resulted in them creating these collective living experiences. And the politics of those experiences are what I address in the article. So they created a system for collective parenting. There was a boarding school that Panther parents could drop their children off on Monday and pick them up on Friday, confident that they had been educated, cared for, fed, cleaned, and everything like that by the staff members who were assigned to work with the children. They tried to create different structures of collective responsibility, and almost an alternative family-type structure for the members of their organization in a way that was very striking. And I think it sort of puts them in line with all of the other communal experiences that were going on at that time, especially in that region of the country. So collective parenting, collective living, the way that grassroots and rank-and-file members shared resources and pooled resources was very, very central to how the Panthers were able to sustain themselves as an organization after the devastating impact of repression on their organization had resulted in such a dramatic loss of members and chapters. So I think in a lot of ways the Panthers kind of are an exciting group to look at because they really represent so much. They were international, and they had that impact. Their organizational structure was very innovative. Some of the things that they experimented with were very critical to sort of redefining or rethinking what community would look like, what the society after the revolution they imagined might look like as well. So they really tried to make their organization a microcosm of the world they wanted to see, even as they struggled with all of the isms that were part of their context, part of their makeups, and things that they were trying to re-educate themselves around eradicating.
Okay, thank you. That's been very interesting. Let's shift just a bit, and it's not too far from that. You teach social history, urban history, radical history, Black history, and you're interested in gender. Maybe you could say a word for our listeners and myself about the challenges of working in, say, Black history and gender history at the same time, simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so, well, thank you for asking. Wonderful question. I think in a lot of ways, there's a very well-known book that came out in the 70s called All the Women Are White, All the Blacks Are Men, But Some of Us Are Brave. And I think that sort of in a nutshell embodies the very challenge. So oftentimes in the context of African-American studies, despite the fact of the rich and long tradition of Black women's involvement in all aspects of Black social policy, Black social protest, Black cultural life, etc., because of patriarchal assumptions, because of the way in which men's experiences are oftentimes used to stand in for community experiences, the story of African-American women has always had to push and fight for a place at the table. And certainly the table is more inclusive than it's ever been at this particular moment. But I find that when my students come into my classroom, for example, my civil rights class, right, which is not a women's history class, and I ask them to talk to me about the leaders that they've heard of or what knowledge they're coming in with, most of them cannot name any woman outside of Rosa Parks. And if I push them, I might get Mrs. King, right, or Betty Shabazz, you know, wives of. That's who they understand them to be. Of course, those women were very dynamic and influential in their own ways, but they only appear in the eyes of those students as wives of. So the struggle is really to argue that women's experiences were central to all aspects of Black history, and they are appropriate in a survey class, in a civil rights class, in a topics class, and not just relegated to a women's history class. And I think that is sometimes a challenge. Like this semester in my civil rights class, we're reading a wonderful book by Danielle McGuire, At the Dark End of the Street, which looks at, sort of reframes the history of the civil rights movement, connecting it to a movement against the rape of Black women, which was prevalent, you know, all throughout the 20th century. And for students, it's a new concept to sort of link that kind of violence. They're very aware of the violence of lynching, which they tend not to see in a gendered way. But the story of lynching is oftentimes told in a gendered way because of the accusations around Black men molesting white women and things like that. But they don't know anything about the violence that women may have faced in the same period that also may have contributed to this upsurge in activism and this desire for, you know, self-determination and voice. So this is some of the struggle. I feel like in some ways it's an uphill battle because every day new books are coming out that continue to exclude women or to marginalize them in different ways. But I feel like once the information is presented, the centrality of women, it's hard to ignore. You realize you don't have the full story of it. Like I was just even teaching about the slave trade and those iconic images of what the inside of slave ships look like with all of the bodies piled up on top of each other. And I told them that women's experiences were a little outside of that. That women had relative freedom of movement on those slave ships, which they used to help bring people together for rebellions and to translate and to become really linguists on the fly as they tried to bring messages. At the same time, their relative freedom meant that they were sexually assaulted, you know, on those ships as well. And that's part of the story of the slave trade. So I feel like I'm constantly, it feels like a stealth activity. But I think inserting women and making sure that women's voices are heard is just so central. And I feel like the pushback is almost non-existent, I feel, because it's undeniable. It's undeniable. Hmm. So, the pushback is in a way strong, but for me, I see it as almost, you know, it's non-existent to me because I feel like you really can't understand that part of the equation if you don't have the contributions and experiences of black women.
Maybe you wouldn't mind telling us about a black woman who you find interesting or admire in the history of the black struggle for freedom. Just, pick out just anyone and tell us a little bit about what they did and how they fit into your history, your view of history.
Oh, wonderful question. Well, one woman comes to mind. Well, I'll sneak in two women. The first woman I don't know a lot about. She's a woman who was around in the colonial period. Her name was Frances Drigas. And she came to my notice because she appeared in the margins of a video that I show about colonial America to my survey class. And I did some more research on her. And I found out that Frances Drigas was somebody who actually in this time period, in the colonial period, dared to take her owner to court. She charged him with fornication because she was being sexually assaulted by him. Her claim was denied, and she was punished with lashes. She tried again later on when she became pregnant, and her owner tried to charge her with fornication. So, I mean, the bitter irony, I think, of this woman's situation is so telling to me, that she's someone who's being victimized, yet she's trying to use the court to gain some redress, but then the court is against her at every turn. And I like to tell her story because even though she's not a woman that is well known or that we could easily Google and find a lot of information about, she's just one story of many, but it speaks to a spirit of resistance. It speaks to a sense of dignity, of self, right? The ideal that one is deserving of redress. And I think that spirit is so important. She wasn't a part of any movement, but yet she was part of a spirit of resistance, I think, that we can see that carries on later on to other women who organized maybe in a more visible and vocal way in the post-World War II period, which is tends to be my favorite time period to look for protest in as well. So she's one woman I can talk about. I can sneak in a second, but I don't want to overgo our time.
No, go ahead. We've got time. I'd like to hear.
Oh, wonderful. Well, then, a woman that I'd love to talk about, Septima Clark. Septima Clark is kind of an unsung hero of the civil rights movement. She was an educator. I think that sometimes when we think about what it took to get someone to become a voter, it seems like the maiden task is to get, you know, motivate them to overcome the fear and to survive all of the challenges and the violence that's facing them when they try to go down and register to vote. But Septima Clark understood that people needed education. They needed to understand what citizenship was, what civics was. They had their own sense of it. It's not that they were tabula rosa or anything like that. They were certainly aware, but they had never had, you know, you think about what's going on in the 50s and early 60s in parts of the rural South, they maybe had never had that relationship to a governing authority. And the things that she put together in the curriculum of these citizenship schools, the way in which she reached out and created curriculum that was appropriate not just for people who were younger voters, but people who were in their 60s and 70s, and learning not just how to vote, but sometimes even how to read in a complex way or to understand complex concepts, to me, I feel like that's really doing the work. You know, that that is what was needed. And it's not romantic. It's not someone with a, you know, like a weapon, like one would imagine the Panthers confronting injustice. But still, by providing education, she is empowering people to confront injustice and empowering them to feel like they can take the step to go down and register to vote and to understand what their rights are. So I really like to focus on her. Plus, as an educator myself, I feel like sometimes, you know, educators are just not as valued, even though we understand it's our common experience, right? I mean, we know that we need this to advance intellectually, sometimes financially, as a people, as a citizenry, as a country, but somehow educators don't get held up in the same way as others. So I try to hold up Septima Clark, because she really did that work by creating these network of schools that were staffed by people. And again, she's not a well-known name. You don't see her on marches with picket signs or things like that. Yet what she did was so important.
Okay, I think this might be a time, if you don't mind, for me to ask you about a little bit about yourself. How did you, how did you get interested in history? How did you decide on history as a vocation?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I always liked social studies, and my mom is the type, she kept all of my little certificates, and I always had, like, even from like first grade on, I would always have these little certificates of excellence in social studies. I like stories. I think the type of stories that I was being told, I had a good memory. It was easy for me to excel in that subject. When I went to high school, my high school teacher took a special interest in me, I would say. Of course, the tests at that time were your multiple choice tests, and, you know, I did well on them. And he invited me to be part of a student group called Close Up, and Close Up is still around today. The idea is they encourage high school students to fundraise to get themselves to Washington, D.C., where they spend 1 week looking at government, quote-unquote, close-up. So, I was able to join this club, and I sold the candy, and I was able to fund myself to go to D.C. For the close-up experience. And I went 2 years in a row. We went to Colonial Williamsburg. We went to the National Archives. We went to so many places that made history come alive for me, because before that, history was just stories I was reading in the books that were interesting, but to actually go and see, you know, we went to Congress to see, you know, the process of laws being made, to go to the Supreme Court, to visit the monuments, and to think about public history and how history is being presented to the public, it was a really powerful experience for me. So when I went into college, I just would take history classes. Now, I was also very good in science and math, and I was determined to become a doctor, a medical doctor, and so I started out on sort of the pre-med track, but all of my elective classes were in history. And I remember that I went to SUNY Binghamton, and there were so many wonderful professors there at the time, and I had Paul Finkelman, who's a renowned legal historian. I was teaching the Civil War. I remember on the same day I got my test back from the Civil War class, he's like, oh, you know, this is excellent. This is the best, you know, test in the class. You know, we're looking for TAs. You're interested in that? And then I went into my biology class, and I was at the bottom of the curve, and I was just, it was just like a totally different experience. It's like a light bulb went off, and I felt like, you know, I have an affinity for this, and I'm interested in this. And this is going to help me understand my world, you know, to go from where I was living in New York to a school upstate, not a lot of black people, Klan activity and things like that. I mean, going away to college was a real eye-opener for me. And it soon became clear that my science classes were not engaging me in the world that I was increasingly interested in. So I declared my history major. And I started speaking to my professors about careers, and I always thought the teaching, I think today when you speak to people about history careers, you get a big conversation going about museums and historical societies and industry and all sorts of things. But at that time, when I started to speak about a career in history, it was mainly teaching that was being promoted as sort of the primary path that people would go on to. So I just kind of went from there, and I just became interested in social movements and international politics as an undergrad, and I continued on mainly in social movements as a graduate student, and I'm circling back around to international politics now, now that my Panther work is over.
This is KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host this afternoon, Cal Winslow. Our guest is the historian Robin Spencer. She's a professor of history at the Lehman College in the City University of New York, and we've been talking about the Black Panther Party and about politics and Black politics and gender. Robin, here's a question. I hope this isn't out of the blue, but I saw this on your resume and it kind of intrigued me. You wrote a piece called Mad at History. What's that about? Do you mind?
Mad at History was about a teaching experience I had while teaching at Lehman. One of the great things about teaching at Lehman College in the Bronx, part of the City University of New York, is that, the Bronx, I should say, is the poorest borough of the city of New York. And the students that I get tend to come from very underfunded schools, overcrowded, and sometimes they are working adults, so they're not coming directly from high school. So they come in with a range of experiences around history. That's what I'm used to. One year I taught a class which was all 18-year-olds, which is a more traditional college classroom, which I had never taught before at Lehman College. And I started out, it was a survey course, and I started out with my usual, the African civilizations, into the slave trade, into the racialization of slavery, etc. And I had one particular student who I felt was resisting in ways that I was not accustomed to. Right? We're not used to, as professors, dealing with a lot of behavioral issues. I think people tend just not to show up, or, you know, behavioral issues are not a huge part of what we cope with in terms of classroom environment. But this particular student was really resisting by talking when I was talking, and really attention-seeking behavior, you know. And, I just would speak to him after class because I could tell that he liked the class, he was engaged, yet he was resisting. And finally, one day, he blurted out, asking, now that there's a Black president, do I think that he would enslave white people? And it was just one of those things, you know, as a professor, you kind of have to field all the balls. You can't really have a lot of time to respond, you know, go into your mind for deep responses. You just kind of have to react. And before I could say anything, all the hands shot up. So then the students kind of spoke about, you know, Obama and the, you know, Brotherhood of Man and all of those wonderful things. And so I decided, well, I wasn't going to say much, because it felt like a bludgeoning, because no one agreed with him in some ways. And I could see him kind of shrinking. I didn't want to, you know, contribute further. But I spoke to him after class, and, you know, he just expressed his frustration. He felt like Black history was depressing, that it was sort of this collective beatdown, and he couldn't imagine it getting any better, because we were barely into, you know, we were barely had cracked 1800s, and he felt like it was just this litany of depressing oppression, and he was angry at that. You know, he expressed a lot of anger at the things that were going on in his life, the fact that despite of this Black president, you know, he's harassed by the police on his daily walk back and forth to school. We don't have dorms. We, you know, the school is in a, you know, a neighborhood relatively poor, and, you know, he talked about just his daily realities had not changed So he was angry that people felt encouraged in some ways and optimistic when he only saw bleakness around him in history and in his contemporary moments. So it was really, I think, one of my most, sort of soul-searching teaching moments, because I realized that, first of all, how do you talk about enslavement? It's not a happy story, right? We can talk about resistance and survivals and cultural richness and all of that, but we're also talking about rapes and abuse and the breaking apart of families and all of that. And is it our job? It really made me think about sort of what is our job as historians. Is it to, how do we acknowledge the pain of history, yet tell a story that is reflective of the fact that people survived? Because I think that one of the things I try to get my students to do is just relate to the historical moments, because oftentimes they can't relate to it. They have visions of if they were enslaved, they would be Nat Turner, and if they were in the 60s, they'd be Malcolm X. And, you know, there's no real sense of, like, sort of trying to gain a more richer appreciation of what life was like. So I felt like, you know, I just expressed to him that, look, hey, I get angry too. You know, definitely as I have watched some of the stories and the movies and you read about the happenings and the account, you know, it's gut-wrenching. It seems inhumane, right, when you're talking about lynchings and, you know, the fact that people kept body parts as souvenirs. Like, how do you make that okay for people? So it really got me to thinking about just the role of scholars and teachers and just the emotional part of history and it being okay to tell the students, you know, and as I told him, hey, look, I get angry too. You know, I'm not up here unemotional about these things, you know, because they were bad things, but it's not just about those things as well. So that, you know, I wrote an essay about that experience, and it made it more, it just was a reminder to me, just don't forget the humanity, because I think it's sometimes easy to breeze through, especially a survey class. You've got 15 weeks, you're going through hundreds of years, you've got to hit certain marks. You know, sometimes you do just have to pause and say or try to provide a place for people to process their relationship to what they're learning. And so it made me, I think, a more aware teacher.
All right, thanks for that. And now maybe shift a little bit in the time we've got left. I've been interested, Robin, in hearing about your travels. I don't know if it's sort of, are you sort of a historian educating yourself, or but you've got very interesting things to say about going to the South, to Africa, to Palestine. Could you say how that's become part of your life?
Well, definitely. I mean, I love history. I mean, I just love history. It's you know, it's not just my job, but it's, you know, I sort of see it all around me. I like to go and engage with it in a lot of ways. And over the summer, I had the chance to go down to the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer Conference. And for me, it was an opportunity to go down to Jackson, Mississippi. I'd never been to Mississippi before. And Mississippi is just such a place, you know, such a momentous place in Black history, whether it be from the period of enslavement and the Black Belt. I wrote my master's essay on the Mississippi flood of 1927 and the impact that that had on African Americans, to the role of Herbert Hoover and the Red Cross as a relief agency in that political moment. Then, of course, you have Mississippi in the 60s and all of the civil rights events that unfolded in Mississippi. Mississippi, of course, you know, during the Civil War, lots of Civil War battle things as well. So going to Mississippi was really exciting for me because I knew that I wouldn't just attend the conference, but I would also try to go out and see how they were remembering this history. Because oftentimes when you go out there, and I've done a lot of historical travel, when you go to historic homes and to small museums, sometimes the versions of history you presented are not very nuanced, are not very, they kind of perpetuate a cycle of miseducation around the event or the person or the experience that the home or museum is supposed to represent. So I got a chance to go to many different places. Some of the highlights, I went to the store where Emmett Till, the faithful store, where the Bryant store where Emmett Till in 55 went in and broke the rules of Jim Crow and paid for his life. So I got a chance to actually go to that store and just sort of see where it was. I think that's so important, just to be able to imagine what it may have looked like and think about, you know, him there at the moment. I got a chance to go to Medgar Evers' home. It was another highlight, civil rights leader who was killed in 1963. And the bloodstains, he was shot down in his driveway of his home. The bloodstains are actually still there in the driveway all of these decades later, and they claim in the home that it's been tested, and you know, and that's what these particular stains are that sort of greet you when you get there. But it made it very, 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 very real. I got a chance to go to Alabama, and really just through walking around, I went to the Rosa Parks Museum, which is a different experience. The Rosa Parks Museum is a multimedia, probably million-dollar type of facility with all sorts of interactive, kid-friendly, adult-friendly, gift shop. You know, that's really a more institutionalized attempt to preserve that history. And then we also went to places where it would just be a sign there acknowledging that this was an important office of this particular organization, or that a sit-in happened here or a freedom ride happened there, but nothing else but the marker. So it really made me think about, like, just how history is preserved, what are people getting as they sort of go back and forth. I got a chance to go to Senegal over the summer as well, when I went to Gorée, which is an island off the coast of Senegal, where they have slave castles where people were brought and slave trading happened, and people were then put onto ships, Africans, and sent off into the New World. So I got a chance to see one aspect of what the slave trade was like, and also to see the tools of punishment that were used on people who fought back while they were there, while they were being held there. Very historic place. President Obama has been there, President Bush has been there, President Clinton has been there. Every American president that has gone to Senegal in the past few decades has made that trip because of its historic importance. So it was very important to me to go there, even though it felt like a very weighty trip because of this imagining the disjuncture of that break from being an African in the interior to now being an African on the way to who knows where. You don't know where. You put yourself in someone's shoes. So that was great. And earlier the year in January, I was part of a delegation to Palestine, an African-American delegation with many others. There were nine of us in total: Dream Hampton, journalist, filmmaker, writer, Jasiri X, hip-hop artist, Bill Fletcher, labor union activist, Graylin Hager, pastor, and others. And we went down and really saw and experienced, you know, what life is really like in the West Bank. And so we went to many different locations. We spoke to different people, farmers, ordinary people, about the impact of the occupation on their daily lives and their continuing resistance to and struggle for autonomy and for self-preservation as an individual and as a people, as a Palestinian people. So I've been on the road and out of the country, and I always take my love for history with me and my critical thinking skills, because I'm always thinking about, you know, how the filters and what's being presented and what's being left out, and, you know, choices that people are making as they, you know, put together these monuments and museums and tours and things like that as well. So it's really an exciting world out there. And I think sometimes we think we need to go far away to be excited, but, you know, the concept of a staycation and taking trips centered around history, not just beaches and things like that, even though beaches are wonderful, is just something I try to embrace.
And if I'm right, you came back from Palestine with some new commitments. And it seems like possibly public opinion is changing, maybe especially after this summer of slaughter about Palestine. What's your take on that?
Well, I feel like I came back, and because I didn't really know much before, I understood that something, you know, I understood it was a place of crisis, and I had laid my stakes with the Palestinian people, but I didn't have any detail, really. You know, it was abstract to me. Having gone there and seeing how it is on the ground is horrible. You know, the racism, the segregation, the dispossession, the lack of resources, you know, the situation is horrible. And then the Gazan attack and massacres on top of that, I think, was really stunning, because even as the world shifted to Gaza and the impact of the bombings and the killings and all of that was going on there, in other parts of the West Bank, of course, normalcy is actually almost warfare. You know, even though people aren't being bombed, but, you know, their movement is being hampered. They're being denied access to medical care. They're being denied access to their families. They have to go through these checkpoints. I mean, all of these things were still going on. So I feel like in some ways it reminded me that, you know, our commitments have to be bigger than the news cycle. Just like any news thing on the news, you know, whether it be about Ferguson or about the Gazan war, people will quickly, you know, the news cycle moves on. And sometimes your attention span goes with that. But for me, when I think about the questions going on in Palestine, I have to think about just the long-term reality, just the fact of Gaza itself, and to think about the separation of the Palestinian people, the creation of the refugee status of so many of them, and the scattering of the bodies and people's attempts desperately to keep together culture, family, and community, and resistance amongst all of that, I think really made me see that it's really an ongoing thing. Just like for what's happened in Ferguson, there'll always be, unfortunately, another news story, another name to remember, Trayvon Martin. We have so many of them now that we carry in our hearts. But we have to go beyond the news to the root systematic causes and the unsensationalistic violence of daily life that happens in so many societies, including ours. And I think that's kind of the root cause to address. So that's what I try to focus on. I've had the chance to talk about it a little bit, and do some organizing around it as well. So,
well, thanks, Robin. And Robin, my last question was going to be about Michael Brown and Ferguson and the fact that it seems so similar in ways to episodes both in current and past history. So maybe in just in the minute we have left, how do you place what's been going on this summer and its significance?
Right. I mean, when I saw what was going on, I saw it from afar because I was in Senegal at that point. It brought together so many things: the militarization of the police forces, the loss and pain faced by individual black families, around the violence that you know faces their family members, the response of people, activists going down in support of Ferguson was very important, as well as the role of social media, just spreading the word, sharing pictures, images, countering some of the and complicating some of the news that was coming out about what was really going on the ground. So I felt like it was a moment of new movement. It sort of illustrated how the movement for social justice had shifted yet remained the same, right? Because, you know, these images took me back to the, you know, Watts. You know, you see all of these these images of the past of repression and resistance. So in a lot of ways, it made me think about history as well as sort of what is new, what can be done now, and to think about what does it mean to have systematic change around this question of police brutality. Is it always going to be like this? Do we have to accept that? What can be done to envision another future? And how the resistance of working class people, the raw resistance, oftentimes is what it's taken to up the ante, right? And I think that's the lesson of the 60s as well, that oftentimes it was those flashpoints of resistance that spurned responses, whether it be negotiation or repression. So that's kind of how I tried to put it together in my mind. I'm still sort of gathering, I would say, gathering information and reading to really try to understand, like, what are the long-term prospects? I feel like these things come on the news, and then we forget and we move on, like, Stand Your Ground in Florida. I mean, I think this came up around Trayvon Martin, of course, and then these things fade out. But the question is, how do we remain committed to making the policy changes and then understanding that sometimes those policy changes may have short-term effects that are positive, but how do we get to those root causes to really cut, you know, envision a different future?
Can
we don't have to deal with this any longer.
Okay. On that note, we've run out of time, but I want to thank you very much, Professor Robin Spencer. Robin is a professor of history at Lehman College at the City University of New York. We've been talking to her about her teaching, history, gender, travel. It's been a great pleasure, Professor Spencer. Thank you very much. And I also want to thank our listeners for tuning in. Today's program has been an Antinomian Hour. And this is your host, Cal Winslow. Good afternoon.